Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How big a threat does a nuclear North Korea pose to the broader world? And what responsibility does the United States bear for the apparent resurgence of its weapons development? President Bush sent Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill to Pyongyang yesterday with orders to try and defuse the North Koreans' stated plans to resume operations at a fuel reprocessing plant, which could make weapons-grade plutonium out of spent fuel rods. So why is North Korea reneging on its promise to dismantle that plant? Is the uncertain state of Kim Jong-il's health a factor in recent defiance? And to what extent has the Bush administration and its predecessors played a role in North Korea's renewed aggressions? Mike Chinoy is Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy and a former senior Asia correspondent for CNN. His new book is called Meltdown, the inside story of the North Korean nuclear crisis. Mike, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So we know that the IAEA has been ejected from the facility in Yongbyon. What do we know for sure about what is taking place there right now, if anything?
Well, the North Koreans have begun a series of steps that, if not reversed, will lead to the restarting of their nuclear program and their ability to make more weapons-grade plutonium. The conventional narrative about why this has happened is that it's the North reneging on its commitments and in yet another display of the kind of provocative behavior that they're so well known for, are essentially throwing out everything they've agreed to before. The reality, however, I think is really quite different. My own sense, and this comes from talking to and a lot of the same people I interviewed for my book, Meltdown, and what I know about the internal policy dynamics, is that it's really the other way around. The deal that the North Koreans signed last year with the United States committed the North to provide a declaration of its nuclear facilities. And in return, the U.S. was supposed to take North Korea off Washington's list of states that sponsor terrorism. When the North Koreans gave the declaration at the end of June, hardliners in the Bush administration, and I should point out that the Bush administration has been bitterly divided from the beginning, and this is something I chronicle at length and in a lot of colorful detail in my book, between those who wanted to engage North Korea and those who wanted to confront North Korea. Anyway, hardliners felt that the declaration was insufficient and that the U.S. negotiator, Christopher Hill, had given too much away. And so they pushed back and they demanded that the administration insist that North Korea agree in advance to this verification protocol for verifying what was in the declaration and the scale of the North's nuclear program before they be taken off the list. And President Bush and Secretary of State Rice eventually bowed to that pressure and added that condition. The North Koreans say there's nothing in any of the agreements that we signed last year that requires us in advance to submit to this very intrusive verification protocol. And so it's you, the United States, who are reneging. And if you don't change your tune, then we're not going to follow our part of the deal and we're going to restart our reactor. So I think this is the North Koreans, in fact, pushing back against what they see as the U.S. changing the goalposts and not the other way around.
Yeah, so from their perspective, it's like a bait and switch. Like we agreed to pay so much for a car and then we said no, or for them to pay so much, and then we said no, it's $5,000 more.
To some degree. I mean, it's very complicated because there is no question that the North's declaration didn't, in fact, address a number of key U.S. concerns, including what kind of uranium enrichment program North Korea may have had and the nature of its nuclear dealings with Syria. But the argument that Assistant Secretary of State Hill made was that in both of these issues, they don't present immediate threats. The U.S. intelligence about a uranium program has shown only an attempt several years ago to procure components. There's never been any intelligence. They actually have a facility that they could make a uranium bomb. And whatever they may have been doing with Syria, in September of 2007, Israel bombed that site, so it's just a pile of rubble. So it's not an immediate threat. And Hill argued that the immediate danger was this plutonium-based program at the Yongbyon reactor and that the U.S. needed to continue the process of disabling that, rolling that back, and could address these other issues later. But this cut to the heart of the whole debate in Washington about whether you could cut the North Koreans any slack or whether they're so untrustworthy you had to kind of push them even more. But predictably, and one of the patterns in my book Meltdown that comes through over and over is that when the North Koreans are pushed, instead of bowing to that pressure, they push back even harder. And so the decision to insist on this intrusive verification mechanism triggered precisely the response you would expect from the North Koreans, which is to say, if you want to play hardball, we can play harder than you. And so they have, in fact, restarted the reactor. And if Hill doesn't come up with a compromise deal right around the time the new president takes office, they'll be manufacturing weapons-grade plutonium again. Could have a major – it could be one of the first major new international crises for the new president.
Well, how much power does Hill have? Because in the book it comes across that both secretaries of state in the Bush administration, Powell and Rice, have pushed for diplomacy and really been sort of steamrolled by Dick Cheney and much more hawkish forces within the White House.
Well, this has been the central problem of the Bush administration's approach from the word go. It was deeply divided. You had the so-called hardliners, the neocons, Vice President Cheney, people in his office, people like John Bolton, who handled arms control and then was at the UN, and a whole host of others who felt that it was morally wrong to deal with North Korea, that any previous deals with them weren't worth the paper they were written on, that the only approach that made any sense was to pressure them, to sanction them, and to confront them. And then you had people like, as you mentioned, Secretary of State Powell and others who felt that you had to talk to North Korea because the alternatives were so bad. And until a couple of years ago, the hardliners really dominated the policymaking process, with the result that you had a policy that was, as one cynic described it, an attitude rather than a policy. It was very confrontational, but the U.S. wasn't prepared to go the final steps like they did in Iraq, for example, because a military option in North Korea is not viable. But in the last couple of years, Christopher Hill, who is no shrinking violet, essentially seized control of the policy process with the backing of Secretary of State Rice, in large part by freezing out his opponents, circumventing the normal bureaucratic process. And I document all the skullduggery and maneuvering because it's quite astonishing the games that were played in my book, Meltdown. But he was able to take control of the process and make, I think, some significant headway in getting the agreement, getting the North Koreans to begin to roll their program back. But now that it's run into trouble, he still has a lot of enemies in Washington. And when the road gets bumpy, he doesn't have a lot of support. And over the summer, because the agreements with the North Koreans had these flaws, it provided an opening for the hardliners to push back. And that's what's happened.
Knowing that it would face sanctions for resuming nuclear development regardless of the scenario, why is North Korea being so public about this? Why not try to secretly develop these weapons and get away with something until it's fully developed?
I think this cuts to the heart of the big question about what's North Korea's overall game here.
What are they trying to get?
What are they trying to get, precisely? I first visited North Korea in 1989 and have made 14 trips since, and I had a number of meetings with Kim Il-sung, the father of the current leader, and I've met a number of other leading North Korean officials. And from talking to them and from everything else that I have understood studying North Korea, North Korea's goal since at least the early 90s has in fact been an accommodation with the United States. The North Koreans looked around the world in the 1990s and they saw all their former communist allies disappear. The contemporaries of Kim Il-sung, Erich Honecker in East Germany, Enver Hoxha in Albania, Ceausescu in Romania were all toppled. Some were killed. So survival in an uncertain, hostile post-Cold War world has been the North Korean game. And the North Korean calculation was that the best way to ensure the survival of their regime and their system was some kind of accommodation in which the United States, which they viewed as their greatest strategic threat, would no longer be an enemy. And developing missiles and developing nukes was part of that strategy on two levels. On the one hand, it was a deterrent because the North Koreans, and when you go to North Korea, it's like going through the looking glass, and from the outside they look menacing, and from the inside we look menacing. So partly it was a deterrent, and partly it was a card to be put on the table, possibly traded away if the price was right. And consistently what the North Koreans have said in their public statements over years and years and years is, if we're not enemies of the United States, we don't need nuclear weapons. The price that they want is obviously very high. So that in that sense, doing this publicly is part of the strategy, because these are cards to be traded away for concessions. And so what they're doing now is, in a very systematic step-by-step way, ratcheting up the restarting of Yongbyon. But they haven't sort of crossed the point of no return, and there might still be an opening for a negotiation. But they've got to get something from the U.S. And however troubling it is that they're doing it and however odious the North Korean system is, they do have cards to play. They've got the bomb and they've got the ability to potentially to make more.
You write in the book about an extraordinary diplomatic mission that U.S. leaders took to North Korea early in the Bush administration, where they were given a set of instructions, essentially, and told, okay, this is what you need to do. And nobody told them what to do if the North Koreans actually made a move toward rapprochement.
Well, this episode in October of 2002 was really the catalyst for the nuclear crisis that followed, the catalyst for North Korea staging its nuclear breakout, conducting a nuclear test, and becoming a nuclear power. It's a very important moment. The episode focuses on a delegation led by then Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, James Kelly. It came after American intelligence in the spring and summer of 2002 had discovered that the North Koreans had been engaged in a large-scale effort to procure components that could be used to build a uranium nuclear bomb. Previously, the North's nuclear program was all based on plutonium. What's interesting about this, there are a number of things. One is that that intelligence set off a fierce debate within the administration, pitting the usual suspects, the hardliners and the engagers. The engagers in the State Department felt this was a very serious problem, and the way to address it was to go to North Korea and say, in the context of improving our relations, we have to get to the bottom of this. The hardliners saw this as an example of North Korean treachery, cheating. It proved you couldn't do business with them, and they pushed that the U.S. needed to confront North Korea. Eventually, as I write in Meltdown, Vice President Cheney intervened with President Bush, and the order came down that when Assistant Secretary of State Kelly went to North Korea, he had to simply demand that they end this uranium effort and not negotiate on anything else. And reflective of the hardliners' antipathy to North Korea, Kelly was also told he was not allowed to host a banquet for his North Korean counterparts, and he was not allowed at the banquet that they gave for him on the first night to raise his glass in a toast, which is normal diplomatic procedure. And then the North Koreans, in the meetings when he challenged them, came back with statements that Kelly's group interpreted as a North Korean admission that the U.S. was right. They did have a uranium program. Based on interviews I did with most members of Kelly's delegation and on interviews I did for the book with people who saw the transcript, it is not at all clear the North Koreans made that admission. The language is much more ambiguous, and up to now the Bush administration has refused to declassify the transcript, so we don't actually know. But the perception that the North had made this admission, the fact that Kelly was not allowed to respond to a North Korean offer to pursue negotiations on it, meant that when he came back to Washington, the decision was they've cheated, they've admitted it, we have to push them. So the U.S. cut off shipments of oil that it had been giving North Korea under a 1994 deal called the Agreed Framework. That triggered the North Koreans to unfreeze their nuclear reactor, which had been shut down since 94. And soon after, they were making weapons-grade plutonium. And so at that point, the North had enough plutonium for one or two bombs. Now it has enough for anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10. And it's going to be much harder to roll it back because it's a much larger arsenal.
My guest is Mike Chinoy. He is Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He is also former senior Asia correspondent for CNN. His new book is called Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. You can see him tonight at an address for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Find information about that at dfwworld.org. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment. You can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mike Chinoy is my guest. His new book is called Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Is there any possibility, Mike, that this is a bluff on the part of the North Koreans?
I think the North Koreans are still open to negotiating here, although there are some question marks because there's uncertainty now about who's in charge in North Korea because apparently Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader, has had health problems. So it's not inconceivable that at some point this might change. But the indications are so far that what the North Koreans have said is this is an issue of sequencing. If you take us off the terrorism list, we can figure out something on verification and move forward. And that's what Assistant Secretary of State Chris Real is trying to do. But it is, as I say, it is possible if the leadership configuration changes that whoever is calling the shots in North Korea may say, this gives us an opening to restart a nuclear program that our security apparatus and army was never thrilled about rolling back at all. So we're poised at a kind of very important moment here and without any real clarity about where this is going to go.
Well, you mentioned this question about who's in charge. We certainly haven't seen Kim since it was announced that he had a stroke, and it seems that if they said that out loud, who knows what's going on behind the scenes. He does have three sons himself, but it doesn't seem clear that any one of them has been tapped to succeed him.
Right. Well, for their part, the North Koreans, in fact, have not said, if not publicly acknowledged, that anything is wrong with him. But the evidence seems pretty clear from people who have talked to the Chinese sent a team of doctors in mid-August, that he had some kind of major health event, most likely a stroke, that has impaired him in some way. Beyond that, the reality is we simply don't know. But what this does is that it puts front and center the question of the succession. North Korea is one of these. It's a strange place where you have the sort of communist dynasty. And in many ways, North Korea is less communist than a kind of religious cult with traces of Korean Confucian, respecting the elder and the traditional role of the all-powerful emperor and so on. But in any case, Kim Jong-il succeeded his father, and you're right, he has three sons. By the time Kim Jong-il's father was 66, Kim Jong-il had already been groomed. It was clear in the media that he was taking a political role. It was clear he was the heir, and his father lived until he was in his early 80s, so Kim had 20 years to learn the ropes and consolidate his power. But none of Kim's three sons have been put in that position. All of them have question marks. And so there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about what would happen. The likeliest scenario seems to be that some kind of group of very senior officials around Kim in the army and the ruling party would actually call the shots, and possibly one of his sons would be put forward as a figurehead. But we don't know, and given the stresses and strains on North Korea, the fact that they don't know adds another element of uncertainty.
So is it reasonable to speculate that this new round of aggressive behavior is reflective of an internal power struggle, someone who wants to, while Kim is down, take over and prove that he's got the moxie to take on the United States?
I don't buy that. I think this North Korean behavior is very consistent with their pattern. It's a tit for tat. When the U.S. is willing to engage and deal with them, the record has shown that they are themselves willing to deal. When the U.S. tries to coerce them, to use pressure to bend them to Washington's will, the North Koreans push back and often push back harder. This episode, as best I can tell, predates any illness by Kim Jong-il. The timing is that in late June, the president announced that he was beginning a process that normally takes 45 days to take them off the terrorism list. And then the end of that time, they said, well, because they haven't agreed to this verification plan, we won't take them off the list. And that came about in the second week of August. And
he basically let the clock run out on the
whole thing. The 45 days came, and then they said, well, you haven't agreed to verification, so even though we've set this in motion, we're not going to actually do it. And the North said, if you don't do it, you're reneging, so we're going to start. Then Kim got sick. So I don't think this is a power grab by hardliners in North Korea seeking to prove their moxie by confronting the U.S. I think this is the North Koreans feeling, yet again, it's the Americans who've moved the goalpost on us, and so we have to push back. The difference, though, is that if Kim is incapacitated and if there is some change in the leadership, they may be less willing to find a negotiated way out. It may provide an opening for people who would like to maintain the nuclear program. So it may be harder to roll back, but I don't buy the argument that this is the origins of it. The origins of it are the U.S. reneged on its promise to delist them, and the North Koreans pushed back.
So now this week the North Koreans are saying, yes, that was very important to us, but at this point we don't care. List us, delist us, we don't care. Does that mean that we've lost some ground in our ability to negotiate peacefully?
Well, I think what it means is the North Koreans are trying to signal in the bluntest way, and this is their style, that if the U.S. thought that this gave them some leverage, that the North was going to somehow tremble and obey because otherwise they'd be taken off the list, the North's response is, we don't really care about the list. That doesn't mean they don't want to get off it, and it doesn't mean that a compromise is impossible. But a compromise is going to have to come from both sides, and I'm not sure, even if the North were willing to show some flexibility, how much flexibility Christopher Hill has. I doubt that the North Koreans will simply say they may demand more because they feel the U.S. has switched signals on them than just taking them off the list.
Michael Chinoy is my guest. He's in town for a World Affairs Council appearance this evening. You can learn about that at dfwworld.org. The book is called Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. You can join us by phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. John writes, do other countries look to our state sponsors of terrorism watch list to know what countries are or are not sponsors of terrorism, and do other countries maintain their own lists?
I'm not, to be honest, about other countries, I don't really know. This list is a kind of odd list because some of the countries are, in fact, clearly connected with terrorism. But in the case of North Korea, for example, by the judgment of almost anybody who follows the situation closely, there is no evidence whatsoever that North Korea has had anything to do with terrorism since at least the late 1980s. The last known episode of North Korea being involved in terrorism was in 1987 when two North Korean agents blew up a South Korean airliner. Since then, there's no evidence. And so today, the issue of terrorism has no relationship to the fact to whether North Korea has any role now with terrorism. It's simply a political tool. And this is why, again, the notion that in June the president can say, I'm beginning this process to take you off the list, and in August say, well, you haven't agreed to verify your nuclear declaration, so you're still on the list. It's not that North Korea was not behaving like a terrorist state in June and suddenly is. This has now just become a tool of American diplomacy. And so I think in that sense, in terms of the issue of terrorism itself, it's lost its meaning. Incidentally, one of the interesting episodes I write about in Meltdown came right after 9/11, when the North Koreans saw 9/11 and immediately got alarmed that they would be lumped in with whatever bad guys the U.S. was going to strike back against. And North Korean diplomats did a couple of things very interesting. One is the North immediately ratified a number of U.N. anti-terrorism protocols that they had not done. And they tried to signal in every possible way that they expressed condolences. They really did not want to be lumped in. And there was a debate in the administration about, should we talk to the North Koreans about terrorism, given their past and given their relations with a number of bad actors around the world? They might have some interesting insights. We should take advantage of this. But yet again, the hardliners said, that's ridiculous. We have nothing to learn from them. We're not going to talk to them about this issue at all. But as I say, there's no evidence the North has any involvement in terror. The only question mark is resolving the history of a number of Japanese civilians who were abducted in the 70s and early 80s by North Korean agents. This is a huge issue in Japan, a bit like the fate of Americans missing in action in Indochina was for many years after the end of the Vietnam War, an issue here. And the North Koreans have not come clean on that to the satisfaction of the Japanese. But in terms of activity, for at least 20 years, no evidence whatsoever.
Well, you alluded to this very briefly earlier, but how credible are the allegations that the North Koreans have sold nuclear technology to Syria?
What the Syria relationship is complicated.
It's all complicated.
It's all complicated. As best we can figure out, the Syrians were building a facility that looked like it would go was going to be a nuclear reactor that in some ways strongly resembled the Yongbyon reactor in North Korea. And there is evidence that officials from the North Korean nuclear program had contact with the Syrian nuclear program. There is no evidence that the North Koreans supplied any fissile material to Syria, the stuff you actually blow up, that it was simply helping them to design a building. And there are a couple of points to be made about this. First of all, the North Koreans not being part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and so on, there's no international law that says that one state can't help another state build a nuclear reactor. The obligation is on the part of the state where the reactor is being built to inform the IAEA that it's being built for peaceful purposes. So the North Koreans could technically say we didn't do anything wrong. And in fact, I spoke with a senior South Korean official some months ago who was involved in the six-party talks, and he recounted a conversation with the North Korean, which I write about in my book, where he urged him. He said, why don't you just say, look, we were doing it, but we weren't doing anything wrong. And the North Korean said, we're not going to do this because – and this cuts to my goes to my second point. Syria is our ally. Syria is one of only two countries in the world that has relations with North Korea that refuses to have relations with South Korea, the other one being Cuba. North Korea and Syria have a relationship going back many, many years. The timing of this nuclear cooperation is very interesting. By all accounts, it's late 2002, early 2003. What was going on then elsewhere in the world? On the one hand, North Korea's deal with the U.S. was collapsing under and North had been labeled part of the axis of evil. Pyongyang was concerned about regime change, worrying about that Kim Jong-il might suffer the same fate as Saddam Hussein. The Syrians had been lumped in with Saddam's regime on the side of the bad guys. So it's not altogether surprising to see two states with a long history of cooperation, almost an alliance, cooperating in this way at a time when both of them felt themselves to be an American target. In any case, the North Koreans have said to Assistant Secretary of State Hill that while they're not prepared to give any details about what they were doing, whatever it was, it's not happening now and it won't happen in the future. So it's a very worrisome issue, but the evidence is that whatever it was, the Israelis blew up and it isn't ongoing.
Let's go back and get a little bit of history here. By all accounts, there were no nuclear weapons developed by North Korea during the years of the Clinton administration, although they were very close to actually attacking Yongbyon until, I guess, Jimmy Carter went on a sort of Hail Mary mission.
I was the only journalist to accompany him, so I'm very familiar with the Hail Mary mission.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, basically, in 93 and 94, we had another crisis, which again had to do with the North Koreans not being forthcoming about their nuclear programming and looking like they were moving forward to develop nuclear weapons. The Clinton administration seriously considered military action to take out the Yongbyon reactor. I think the general consensus, certainly of people in the U.S. military, was that would have precipitated a new Korean War with hundreds of thousands of casualties. Then former President Carter, with the Clinton administration not very happy about it, on his own went to North Korea, met the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung. Carter's presence as a former president gave the face-conscious North Koreans enough face that they felt able to back down.
He was an important enough figure.
He was an important enough figure, and it was a gesture of respect and legitimacy that they were able to back down, which enabled the U.S. to back off its threats to take the North Koreans to the UN to demand sanctions and so on. And this led to negotiations, which then in the process of only 3 or 4 months produced an agreement called the Agreed Framework. And under that deal, the North Koreans agreed to freeze operations at Yongbyon. And in return, they got shipments of heavy fuel oil. The U.S. helped work with South Korea and Japan to set up a consortium to build light water reactors, which are nuclear reactors that are generally seen as less able to turn the nuclear material into bombs and so on. And I think there were a couple of very interesting lessons about that relationship to today. Number one, Kim Il-sung died right after the Carter visit. And so even though Kim Jong-il was just consolidating his position, he was still able to endorse a pact with the U.S. that stopped their ability to produce weapons-grade plutonium dead in its tracks. The agreed framework had a lot of flaws. There are a lot of questions about it. But the reality is that from 1994 until the beginning of 2003, they didn't make any weapons-grade plutonium. And had that not happened, when this new crisis erupted, instead of having enough plutonium for one or two bombs, they could have easily had enough for 50 or 100. So I think that the agreed framework was absolutely critical. But again, from North Korea's point of view, this is all about the broader politics, the broader strategic goal, which is they saw this as a step towards eventually ending their conflict with the United States. And I think that has been their goal all along.
And then a clear ally of the United States, South Korea's president, went to President Bush at the beginning of his term and said, keep the framework in place, please. It's working. And what happened?
Well, this is one of the most controversial moments, a pivotal moment in the whole crisis. Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea at the time, had been the architect of what was known as the Sunshine Policy of opening up to North Korea. Kim Dae-jung was a dissident. He'd been jailed by the military dictatorships in North Korea. But he was very clear-eyed about what he was doing. He told an American visitor, North Korea is like a mold, and to get rid of a mold, you need sunshine. So exposing them to greater contact would, in the end, help to change them. But the newly elected President Bush was very suspicious of what Kim Dae-jung was doing, and this meeting was a total disaster. Kim Dae-jung was an elderly, very formal, dignified Asian gentleman. President Bush, fresh from Texas, very informal, very skeptical, and he treated Kim Dae-jung in a way that Kim Dae-jung thought was extremely rude and dismissive. And when I interviewed Kim Dae-jung for the research for my book, Meltdown, I asked him about this meeting, and he said Kim Dae-jung was very he said President Bush was very Texas. And he meant it in a pejorative sense. But it really poisoned the whole relationship between the U.S. and South Korea for many years because the South Koreans felt the Americans wanted confrontation with North Korea, and the South Koreans, would be the ones who would suffer because it was their backyard.
In a minute, we will return to our conversation with Mike Chinoy about his book, Meltdown, the inside story of the North Korean nuclear crisis. We'll also take more of your emails. You can send those to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mike Chinoy. He is Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy and former senior Asia correspondent for CNN. His new book is called Meltdown, the inside story of the North Korean nuclear crisis. You can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. You were talking, Mike, about how the president treated Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president. We really have to step back and also talk about his relationship, if you can call it that, to Kim Jong-il. It has an extraordinary, what appears to be personal, dislike for this man to the extent that he has publicly used the word loathe to describe him.
You're absolutely right. There is something really visceral, personal, in George Bush's view about Kim Jong-il. He said he loathed him. He called him a pygmy and any number of other insulting terms. And again, if you're trying to understand North Korean behavior, you can imagine how this has played. The North Korean system is one in which the leader is really a godlike figure, and the whole society is built around worshiping the leader and deifying the leader. So here you have the president of the most powerful country in the world not only being hostile politically, but being personally insulting towards your great leader. And it's just, I think, another ingredient that fueled this intense animosity and intense distrust. And I think There's always been that. After all, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. They started the Korean War. We sent troops. We have a security alliance with our friends in South Korea. So this goes back a long way. But if you're going to get beyond this throwback to the Cold War, some modicum of trust needs to be established. And one of the things that I write about in Meltdown is the way in which at various points you had these two governments hurling insults like they were five-year-olds screaming at each other. Now, when you've had some progress on the diplomatic front, there's no trust. I mean, certainly there's very little trust on the U.S. side. But if you're North Korea and some American official says, oh, you know, we're not going to invade you, why should you believe them? I mean, and why should they believe anything George Bush says? They are looking for concrete deeds. And so when they see the kind of mixed signals, the pattern of, on the one hand, engagement, on the other hand, confrontation, and that's been played out in this current situation. You had the U.S. announcing that it would take North Korea off the terrorism list and then not doing so. Now, granted, there are issues about, are the North Koreans playing straight with us on what they have on in their nuclear program and so on. But from the North Korean point of view, it's yet another example of the why you can't trust the Americans. It cuts both ways.
An email from Greg in Plano says, in the debate last week, Senator McCain referred to Kim Jong-il as the dear leader. Could this be pandering to the politics of North Korea or a Cold War, War on Terror reference? It struck me as odd that a U.S. representative would provide a reference to what is normally a term of endearment reserved for North Koreans. How might that reverence be seen in the U.S.?
Well, I think he was clearly making a cynical comment.
Sounded sarcastic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does sound very strange to outside ears. So I think that was a way of belittling Kim Jong-il rather than anything else.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'd like to – a great program as always. I'd like the speaker to address the book Aquarium and whether or not it's an accurate portrayal of the Gulag system in North Korea. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
Thanks
you.
For your call.
I think that book and the other accounts are accurate. North Korea is has one of the world's most abysmal human rights records, no question about it. It has a horrible system of labor camps. It's a society in which people who are insufficiently seen as insufficiently loyal to the leadership, or who are perceived in some way as raising doubts about it or behaving inappropriately, can find themselves imprisoned. It's a nightmarish system. There's no doubt whatsoever about it. I think it's important to stress that when you're having a discussion about trying to deal with their nuclear issue, that the effort to engage them diplomatically in no way, and I certainly think this is true for anybody in the U.S. government, in no way implies endorsing sanctioning their internal behavior. It's just there are two separate issues, and North Korea's internal change, how that may or may not come about, is a different one than what's the best way to ensure that North Korea's nuclear program is capped and rolled back and doesn't present a threat to us.
An email from Stephen asks, in college in the late 90s, I remember an international relations professor discussing potential World War III possibilities. He fully believed North Korea would be the main catalyst. This before 9/11 and the continued issues with Iran and the Middle East and Pakistan. Does North Korea still pose a threat to instigate a world war, or has it been depleted to the point that its threat is diminished?
I think there is always a potential threat. This is a country that has an army of over 1 million people. It's a very militarized society. It has nuclear capabilities. But my experience going to North Korea and studying North Korea suggests that while it looks frightening to us on the outside, inside they are as frightened of us, if not more frightened. And in the past, when there was somewhat greater parity between North and South Korea, the concern was that the North Koreans might attempt a military move to reunify the Korean Peninsula, which is what they did in 1950 And that, of course, started the Korean War. Now, I think that's virtually impossible. I think first of all, the North would lose. And secondly, right now, the name of the game for the leadership in Pyongyang is to keep their own system inside North Korea intact. The only circumstances under which I could see North Korea becoming a catalyst for a greater conflict is either if they feel so squeezed by pressure from the United States that they feel they have to lash out, or if there is a degree of internal chaos and turmoil inside the United States that leads to a lack of control over their nuclear arsenal, and some of their nuclear arsenal makes its way into the hands of bad actors outside North Korea, prompting the U.S. to respond. But as menacing and as horrible as North Korea is in terms of the way it treats its own people, and clearly it needs to – it's a security issue that there needs to be tremendous vigilance about. The notion that the North is in any position to start a conflict without being, in its own terms, provoked to an extreme degree, I think, is very unlikely.
So we know that human rights violations are extraordinary in North Korea, and it is continually characterized as a rogue state. But the argument has been made that, you know, for the past quarter century, it has been remarkably internally stable. Is that somehow to our advantage on the world stage?
Well, it's a very complicated issue. The reality is that even though on the surface North Korea looks like it's ripe for collapse, the North Korean government has an abysmal record in the way in which it treats its own people. The economy is an absolute basket case. It has very few international friends. But its political structure and its leadership structure has been remarkably resilient, and I think it remains that way. It's partly because of the isolation and the extreme measures of social and political control. It's partly because the North Korean elite know that if something happens, if they collapse, if they're absorbed by South Korea, they have no future. I mean, look at the number of officials in the former East Germany who were able to retain any positions of privilege after Germany was reunified. Virtually none. So even North Korean senior officials who are aware of the failings of their system, and there are plenty of North Koreans, I've talked to them, who acknowledge privately that there are problems, don't see any alternative. So they have a very strong incentive to keep the system going. And that's why it didn't collapse when Kim Il-sung died. And I think when Kim Jong-il passes from the scene, at least in the near term, it's not going to collapse, but they'll hang on.
If by some set of circumstances South Korea were eventually to reabsorb North Korea, would the extraordinary poverty and the lack of education and the lack of exposure to the outside world for decades that's taken place in North Korea pull South Korea down and its thriving economy and the people who are there?
It would be a huge burden. I think it would depend a great deal on when and how. If Kim Jong-il were to die, North Korea were to implode, South Korea and the U.S. and China had to intervene to prevent it becoming Bosnia or Somalia or, you know, Afghanistan, a kind of failed state model. That's one thing. If Kim Jong-il dies, the succession keeps the place intact. There's an accommodation with the United States that allows a gradual implementation of Chinese-style market reforms, a little greater openness, a little more exposure to soften the hard edges on North Korea, more foreign investment, more joint ventures, and in 25 years you have an accommodation. It would still be a tremendous drain on South Korea's resources, but it would be less traumatic than a kind of cataclysmic collapse.
Let's go to the phone now and speak to Ken in Fort Worth. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hello. Simple question. Is there any way that the next administration is going to be able to repair the damage done in the Middle East and Asia that this current administration has managed to accomplish? I'll take your response off the phone.
Thanks, Ken.
Okay.
I think it depends who the next president is. In terms of Korea, I mean, you raised this a whole separate show to talk about the rest of the region. In terms of Korea, you do have quite different viewpoints in the two campaigns. John McCain has been in many ways more hawkish on North Korea even than George W. Bush. There have been a number of points in the 90s and afterwards where at moments of tension he's called for military action. His advisors have been very critical of the way things have gone recently. So if McCain wins, you may well see the U.S., depending on what situation they inherit with the North Koreans, if there is a compromise deal that resolves this verification issue in the North, it stops the resumption of activity, then the way might be open to resume negotiations. But I don't think that's that likely. And so I think you may see a McCain administration taking a much tougher line, looking to reimpose sanctions. That, I think, would in turn trigger the North Koreans to accelerate their nuclear activity, maybe stage another nuclear test, at the end of which we're going to be back to square one. And I think in the end, there's not much other choice than diplomacy. But I think the odds are that you'd have a much tougher approach from McCain. The Obama campaign, they've been very skeptical and cautious about North Korea, but they're much more open to the idea of negotiations. Talking without conditions to one's adversaries has been something that Senator Obama has talked about. So I think in principle, the Obama campaign would be more open to pursuing these kind of negotiations. But if he wins the election, he will be under a lot of pressure from the Republicans. He'll have other major foreign policy concerns like winding down the war in Iraq, dealing with the crisis in Afghanistan and Pakistan, may not want to open himself up to accusations of being soft on the North Koreans. And in any case, with either administration, you're going to have a transition period. And what's dangerous is if this current deadlock is not resolved, during that transition period, if the North Koreans haven't halted the resumption of activity at their reactor, they'll be going full speed ahead to make more weapons-grade plutonium and increase their nuclear arsenal.
As things develop this week with Christopher Hill in Pyongyang, what specific elements are you listening for or watching for that will give you an indication of how things are progressing?
Well, the talk has been that what Hill is trying to do is to find some way to finesse this issue of how do you get a verification mechanism the North will agree to that will allow the U.S. to take them off the terrorism list without either side saying the other one has caved. The creative idea that's being bounced around is that the North would agree to some principles which they would sort of give to the Chinese, kind of put in escrow with the Chinese, at which point the U.S. might take them off the terrorism list. And then the Chinese would have this document, which they would then pass around. That way the North Koreans could say that they didn't cave, and the U.S. would say, well, we got the North Koreans to do something. The question is whether the North Koreans would accept that without some additional sweetener from Washington. I don't know how much flexibility or leeway Chris Hill has, given the intense opposition to dealing with North Korea from administration hardliners and in the waning days of the administration. So I'm not terribly optimistic, but it's not impossible he could pull a rabbit out of a hat. He's a very skilled negotiator.
Mike Chinoy's new book is called Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn about that appearance at dfwworld.org. Mike, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.